Nothing elicits mock pity at a cocktail party faster than when I complain food writing is really a hard job. Until the head-on assault of the Food Network a decade ago, food writing made even soft journalism, such as fashion and gardening, look butch. But average Americans now know their chefs and food writers like they know the members of their favorite rock bands or sports teams. Despite our boost up the food chain, so to speak, I still maintain being a hired belly should come with hazard pay. Few other jobs pose such a peril to your health. Every day I go to work is one day farther away from being able to wear flat front khakis. And while I won't divulge how much weight I've gained, let's just say I've moved several suit sizes to the right on the clothes rack at Brooks Brothers. Although most of my friends look at me with thinly veiled contempt when I say it, it's still an immutable truth. Travel food writing is the hardest of all. How can being paid to eat in a fabulous foreign city and stay at a cushy five-star hotel be hard, they ask? Well, put yourself in my shoes, I suggest. There you are in, say, Siena. You're armed with a list of restaurant recommendations given to you by the Culinista Underground, a group made up of food professionals, online foodies, and your neighbor's cleaning lady, who just happen to have grown up in the city in question. And to top it off, someone else is picking up the tab. This should be a cakewalk, you brag. You'll knock off the restaurants in 2 days and have the rest of the time to sightsee. You visit the first place, a small, overpriced restaurant now overrun with tourists, where you pay for the spectacular view of the Tuscan hills, certainly not the food. So you try the second place. The dainty, family-run trattoria wedged between a cobbler and a tinsmith is not so twee as to be annoying, but not exactly worth writing home about either. And so it goes. Most of the restaurants get crossed off the list for sundry reasons. Finally, you have only 2 days left and no story. Niente. You accost the concierge at your hotel, hoping he has a special place that would be a perfect hook. You speak in a flurry of pidgin Italian, broken French, and cobbled together Spanish as you try charming favorite spots out of the locals. Your guidebooks, filled with carefully annotated post-it notes of all the art you had planned to take in, lie in the bed, neglected. Out of desperation, you start eating 2 lunches and 2 dinners every day. One night, you find yourself facing a 15-course paean to Hilltown cooking that finally gives you the central theme to your piece. Unfortunately, you pick at your food because not 30 minutes earlier, you were done in by a marvelous but mammoth 7-course meal. Back home, you avoid the scale for a week, and when you finally check, you're up 11 pounds. And still, no compassion. Of course, these same friends without pity are the first to treat me like a walking food encyclopedia or a human Zagat survey. I was at dinner recently with a fellow writer from Geneva who put several questions to me. Why are French fries called French when they originated in Belgium? Why is the main course in America called an entree when that's the French word for starter? And why do Americans use the term maitre d' by itself when you have to be a maitre of something, such as a maitre d'hotel? Suddenly, I was mentally hopscotching from Antwerp to France to the dining rooms of the Plaza Athénée when all I wanted to do was enjoy my plate of tasty Memphis barbecue ribs. But all this badgering has offered up one benefit. I've found a fail-safe way of putting the skids to the Inquisition when it gets out of hand. I simply ask, "Didn't you read my last article? It was all in there." An awkward pause and a wan smile usually follow, affording me just enough respite to make it through dinner uninterrupted.
I'm a slave to my belly, 'cause I've got to be fed. Every morning, well, it lifts me out of bed. It says, "Go to work for me, baby. Buy me some bread and some wine.